Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. From Catholic University in Belgium, saffron, S-A-F-F-R-O-N. Saffron can induce better sleep. This is a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study. That's only one that we're going to be mentioning today. Things that can help improve the quality of our lives and to live a longer life. We'll be sharing that with you. But also today, we're going to do some topics that I'd like your feedback. I'd like to hear what you have to say. For example, we're going to look at a discussion with Matt Taibbi responding to those who, in his mind, quote, the left, the media has lost its mind after protest. Let's see whether you agree or disagree with part or whole what he has to say. He is one of our most honest and courageous investigative reporters. He has been attacked and, wherever possible, canceled. But that's true of all the leading liberal investigative reporting journalists. So you have this great divide between those who are not willing to compromise to be in the club, be accepted, like the reporters of the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, etc., and those who once were a part of that club and are now excluded. They're on their own. And not only on their own, to make sure no one pays attention to them, they're attacked. So that's important. We want to hear what he has to say. Also, interesting about Anthony Fauci saying all along that, oh, you got to wear two, now three masks, and now today, no masks, indoors or outdoors, if you've been vaccinated. But then that raises questions. The vaccine was never tested to see if it would prevent you becoming infected or spreading an infection. That was never tested. No studies on that. It was only done to see if you could keep the infection at a moderate to less severe rate. It did not test to see if it keeps you out of the hospital or death or prevents you getting infected. The very reasons that we did that segment yesterday showing you the actual real prevention level was at 1%. So we've been completely misled. So we're going to have a little segment on Fauci today. Also, we're going to have a segment on revealing the media cover-up of the lab leak hypothesis because more and more energy is being spent on that. More people are looking at it. And what they're coming up with, we'll share with you. So we have a lot to share. And at any time that you would like to call in and share your points of view, please feel free to do so. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. Now, so it's good to know that a simple herb, it's an expensive herb, comes in little tiny threads. And in fact, it's used in a lot of rice dishes, especially Spanish rice. It makes for a very delicious taste. But this was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study. And they found that when they took in the extract of saffron, it allowed for better night's sleep. Good. From the University of Florida comes a study about dealing with neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ALS that affect millions of adults in the United States. But scientists still do not know what causes these diseases, which poses a significant roadblock to developing treatments or preventative measures. Now, in the alternative community, we've had measurable success in dealing with many of these conditions. In fact, just today, the last day of the on-campus anti-aging clinical study based upon modified lifestyle, we filmed a person. We flew in our camera crew from New York, and we filmed a person with multiple sclerosis who was told she would be in a wheelchair and taking medications the rest of her life, and that would be a short life. Now, she's not in a wheelchair. In fact, as we're speaking, I'm watching her complete a long walk. Today is the long walk day. One person's already done 26 miles today. And a 90-year-old is out there. I'll film them, and then you'll have a chance to, I'll stream them, so you'll have a chance to see some of the outtakes from what we're filming. But we had seven people just randomly selected, person who has had major improvement after a stroke, multiple sclerosis, another person who's had pain, really what she called debilitating pain, and that she's a nurse for 20 years. And she turned her neck left to right, said there's no pain, none, zero. And mind you, no matter what she's done, as a nurse, getting the best that medical care can help hasn't made a difference. 4 weeks, pain gone. And so it goes. Alzheimer's, 96-year-old gentleman. And in fact, John saw him, and as I did, and said the same thing. He had that stare, that vacuous stare at the ground. Couldn't talk, couldn't comb his hair, couldn't feed himself. Now he's doing everything himself, including engaging in conversation, and his brain is just as sharp as it can be. He's answering issues coherently and fully. And he's walking upright and with a fast gait. In fact, when he first came, he had to hold onto his wife's arm with a cane. Well, you ought to see him now. Just, it's like a different human being. Now, medicine says that's not possible. And they're right, that you can't reverse multiple sclerosis. And they're also right. And you can't help a person with advanced dementia or Alzheimer's. They're right. And I'm doing it, and I'm right. The world said you couldn't break a four-minute mile running, and they were right. And Bannister broke a four-minute mile, 3:58. He was right. So just understand, no matter what we do, no matter if the outcome of this study, this is the fourth study in a year and a half, all of them showing statistically significant results. It will not make a single bit of difference to the general media, to the scientific or medical community, because they're so locked in to their beliefs. That doesn't mean they're not well-intentioned, don't want to help people. Of course they do. But if you're using the wrong paradigm, no matter what your efforts, the outcomes will not be what they should be. Do they have an openness, an open-minded state where they can actually be at least listening or observing what is happening? And here, everything's transparent. Oh, and by the way, the gentleman, you're listening and you're his wife, just thought you'd like to know that this morning when he came and we filmed him doing the maximum amount of exercise with a rubber ball against the wall, squatting down, back up, he was able to do approximately 100 with great effort. Today, he did 1,500 squats nonstop with that same ball. 1,500. 4 weeks ago, he did 100 struggling. On the whip ropes that you got whip in each hand and big, thick ropes, and they're about 30 feet long and anchored, and you try to whip them, how long you can go. He did about 1:47 first day. Yesterday, he did 32 minutes with ease. Think of the statistical difference from 100 to 1,500 and from under 2 minutes to 32 minutes. They'll say that's not possible, and they're right. But every day we're seeing this, and it is right. So what I'm saying is that individual truths must be measured against universal truths. Universal truths means we have to go outside of the existing bank of knowledge and facts and statistics and protocols to see if there's another way of approaching life's issues. But they won't allow any of that in. So at least those who want to know there's another way of helping stay healthy, live a longer life, and reverse disease, it's available. So anyhow, with this newest study from the University of Florida, they were talking about Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. That's what led me to that little sidebar there. And they don't have any, they're clueless. And that's unfortunate. But there is something that is in the actual peer review literature, because everything I share comes from PubMed's peer review. And what they've done is they're looking now at the vast diversity of microbes found in a person's gut. And by identifying which microbacteria or microbiome or bacteria are associated with neurodegenerative degeneration is like finding needle in a haystack. Seeking the proverbial needle, scientists at the University of Florida are looking in an unexpected place, the digestive tract of a tiny translucent worm, and that is part of the Elegan family. And this was published in the highly respected PLOS Pathogens medical journal. So for the first time, a link between specific bacterial species and physical manifestations of neurodegenerative diseases had been discovered. That's good. And this was someone with the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Now, here's what's important. Think of all of you out there who have been cleaning up your diet, getting rid of meat and sugar and alcohol and caffeine, and replacing with healthy juices, apple juice, tomato juice, grapefruit juice, orange juice, you know, any of the multiple juices you could make or buy that are fresh. And changing over from a meat-based and carbohydrate-based and junk food-based diet to a healthy, clean, plant-based diet. Everyone in the movement is aware of good bacteria and the role that has in helping your immune system stay strong. Well, all of you who've been detoxing and taking in probiotics, like miso or tempeh or sauerkraut, you've been on the right side of this. Now, you may not have known the actual chemistry of it. There's a lot of thousands of studies on your microbiome, but this was the first study to actually find the specific microorganism in the gut that was linked to this. So what if all this time, with all the people that we've had in the anti-aging studies, especially neurodegenerative studies, like the one we did about 14 years ago on brain, where everyone in the study had long-term neurodegeneration, the very first thing is detox and then rebuild the intestine, rebuild the good bacteria. So without knowing the actual science, the whole process of detoxification and rejuvenation was in place. So now it goes back to something I've said thousands of times. Reality always supersedes scientific validation. And yet the highly anal, retentive, reductionistic, Newtonian skeptics and quackbusters, they don't believe in spirit, they don't believe in prayer, they don't believe in energy, no, of the body. No, they just believe in your body's a bunch of cells. When they die, they're dead. It's over. There's nothing else to life. They're wrong. Very wrong. They're not going to open their mind. But for other people, if you've had a closed mind, open it up and you'll see the benefits. So truth ultimately comes out. For example, from the Alzheimer's Research and Preventive Foundation and Thomas Jefferson University, an article published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, the top journal in the field. Meditative practice and spiritual well-being may preserve cognitive function in aging. The very two things that Wikipedia refuses to do anything positive about, what a septic group they are. Whoa. Walk away from Wikipedia. Don't ever use it for anything. Then walk away from the New York Times. Walk away from the networks. And walk away from corporate America, walk away from corporate banking, walk away from these, unless you don't mind the misinformation they provide and the manipulation. Because they don't believe in meditative practice. They don't believe in spiritual well-being. Those are just anathema to them. But here's a study that shows of the 152 million people worldwide living with Alzheimer's disease, and about 6 million plus in the United States, that there's, quote, a growing body of evidence finds that targeting lifestyle and vascular risk factors have a beneficial effect on overall cognitive performance. Okay. They say that a simple 12-minute meditative practice may reduce multiple risk factors of Alzheimer's disease. Quote, examining the spiritual fitness, a new concept in medicine that centers on psychological and spiritual well-being. Wow. So here we have something that was done at not just one university, but also done through the Alzheimer's Research Foundation and the Medicine, Integrative Medicine and Nutritional Science Department of Radiology at Marcus Institute of Integrative Health, Thomas Jefferson University. These are prestigious institutions with really, really open and progressive scientists and clinicians. And they're finding that religious and spiritual involvement can preserve cognitive function as we age. So, spirituality is often experienced outside the context of organized religion and may be part of every religion or separate from it. Spiritual fitness is a new dimension in Alzheimer's prevention, interweaving basic psychological and spiritual well-being. So think of all the people who pooh-hooed all spiritual anything, and they were on the wrong side of that issue. Now there's breakthroughs. Prayer counts. Meditation counts. Sharing positive energy counts. And many of the people around the world have experienced mystical experiences. They're all written off as something, well, something happened in the brain. No, that's just a higher level of consciousness. And by the way, for those who are so certain, where is the mind at? Can you show me any paper that pinpoints in the body? Is it in the brain? No, they're clueless on all these topics. And by the way, from Glasgow University, sitting causes problems with blood sugar levels. So get up and move. That's simple. That's easy. Get up and move. Quote, in fact, walking every 15 minutes for as little as 3 minutes each time at a person's usual pace could be enough to help them control their blood sugar. Could even be as effective as standard diabetes medication. How about that? So don't sit so long. And from the Chinese Academy of Sciences comes a study about grape seed, as it sounds phonetically, G-R-A-P-E-S-E-E-D, grape seed. It has senolytic activity. And that's very important, because what happens is our body ages, we get a decline in multiple organs functioning, and that increases the risk of different pathologies. So as these organs begin to fail and get older, they accumulate what are called senescent, S-E-N-E-S-C-E-N-T, cells, which develop the senescence-associated, what are called SASP, that's senescence-associated secretory phenotype. And that promotes chronic inflammation, and that causes diverse conditions. So when you have a natural product, like grapeseed is one example, there are other examples, and that can help break open that whole process. So it helps the body get rid of these senescent cells. The more grape seed extract you have, the more these dead cells, damaged cells, the body eliminates. So that's good news. I'm Gary Nall. We are almost 19 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to go into one of these videos, and so you can call in afterwards and give your response. This is Matt Taibbi. Remember, he was the top journalist for Rolling Stone for a long time, and then he hit some third rails. There are certain topics, if you write about certain groups, if you criticize, even if you're right and they're wrong, you're wrong, and they'll destroy you. So he's responding. Let's see what he has to say. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
National conversation about race in the workplace has trickled its way into newsrooms and the Twitter sphere. We've seen editors of top publications resign, journalists like Li Fang publicly shamed. And all of this has led journalist Matt Taibbi to write that the American press is destroying itself.
He notes that the process didn't start now and can find its roots in the coverage of the 2016 campaign. And Matt joins us via Skype for more. Matt, great to see you.
Good to see you, Matt.
Good to see you both. Yes, hi.
This piece sparked a lot of conversation. So just lay out the case that you were making for people who haven't read it yet.
You know, I think what we're looking at with this is just a series of incidents where you have people who work in the media who are afraid to report certain things or to express certain opinions on social media because they're afraid of their colleagues. And this is a long developing situation that, as I point out in the article, began, I think, in 2016 when people were they found themselves afraid to say certain things about the Hillary Clinton campaign because they were afraid of being perceived as anti or as pro-Trump or as helping Trump by reporting, you know, negative things about her campaign. And, you know, it's progressed through a series of moral manias. You both know with the Russia story, there was a great deal of ostracization that went on with people who expressed alternative views. And now with this story, we've seen, you know, a dramatic escalation of it, where we've had a series of episodes, including, you know, the incident involving Li Fang at The Intercept, where essentially the problem is if you say a certain thing and an employee accuses you of racism, either your career is over or your reputation is ruined. And right. you, what ends up happening is people just sort of shrink back from wherever they perceive the boundaries are and don't say anything. And that's not a healthy climate for journalism.
No, it is. And one of the things I actually loved most about your piece, Matt, which I actually covered in my radar yesterday, was that self-policing is fine in this case, but as in the cases in which it's politically and morally acceptable to be wrong on, like Russiagate or many of these other areas, there's no self-policing whatsoever in the media. It's only in the in this case where if you express, you know, any contrary idea to the prevailing narrative on Black Lives Matter or even, I mean, even coming from a journalist like Li Fang, that that is a case where you're allowed to self-police within the media.
Yeah, and again, as I point out in the piece, the uprisings within the newsrooms are not geared toward people who make mistakes or who do things that traditionally would give the press a bad reputation. You bring up Russiagate. There were so many instances where editors greenlit articles that should not have been run because they were not properly vetted. They turned out to be factually erroneous. And, you know, it's not just one organization or here and there. It's really pretty much all of them did that, whether we're talking about BuzzFeed with the Steele dossier or the New York Times when they ran that article saying that the Trump campaign had repeated contacts with Russian intelligence, an article that was later repudiated, but it still remains up on this on their site without an editor's note. You know, that is okay to do, and nobody in the staff seems to have a problem with those kinds of factual errors. It's when you disagree with certain theoretical ideas that the colleagues get upset. And that's what I really worry about because it bleeds into the factual coverage, right? So
right.
If you don't fully support the protests, or if you have an indifferent view of the protests, you may be more inclined to focus on things like the rooting and the looting and rioting. But largely, that's not the case. And so what happens as a whole is that in many organizations, they downplay that aspect of the story because they were afraid of writing about it.
Mm-hmm. So, Matt, I think fair to say Sagar and I are both, you know, more sympathetic to your point of view. But I want to represent some of the critique that has come in. Nathan
Sure.
Robinson, in particular, at Current Affairs, wrote a lengthy piece kind of going through point by point. And so I wanted to ask you about a couple of the points that he raised. One of his overarching concerns was the use of the term left. As sort of a broad term, he felt that that was overly broad, that while there is this instinct in some corners of the Democratic Party or the media or the left, that it didn't exist writ large throughout the entirety of the left. What's your view of that?
I'm using an umbrella term to describe a style of thought that I think is primarily emanating from the academia, but has come into the media of late, where it's bullying in tone, it's accusatory, it uses shaming tactics, and it doesn't particularly believe in civil liberties. It's very illiberal in its
yeah.
conception of the world. It does, you know, you hear quite a lot from people who have subscribed to this movement that traditional notions of fairness and balance don't work, so we have to try something else, right? So what I'm describing, I think, really is more the left than traditional liberal, than what you might call liberalism or the, you know, centrist liberals. I do think that one example, in a couple of examples, we've seen the Democratic Party, which is, I think, distinct from the left. They've adopted, like, the language of intersectionality when they felt it suits them, like with Bernie Sanders in 2016. You know, they started calling him a sexist and racist and saying that he was an old white cis male who was out of touch with identity politics. You will see that, but I think that language and that tactic comes more from what we would call the left than it does from, say, the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. And the specific, and so people who didn't follow what happened with Li Fang at The Intercept, which has kind of been the flashpoint for your piece, also for Jonathan Chait, wrote a piece sort of in a similar vein, which is interesting because he's kind of like a neoliberal. I don't agree with him on that many things, right. But I thought he wrote a decent piece here. So Lee shared an interview from an African American who was part of the protest, who basically said, you know, why are we only concerned when Black lives are taken by white people? Where's the concern? I want to see the concern also when Black lives are taken by Black people. And this was upsetting and controversial to some people because it is a trope to always turn around and say, oh, well, what about Black on Black crime? And so Lee shared this interview, not his words, that, you know, from this protester. And another colleague at The Intercept essentially called him out on Twitter, and this is things sort of devolved from there. So the pushback from Nathan Robinson, go ahead.
Crucially used the word racist.
Yes,
important point. So and so the criticism from Nathan Robinson was, look, Lee ultimately realized that he'd been insensitive in some of his remarks. He apologized of his own free will. He still has his job. So no one was deplatformed. No one was canceled. No one lost their job. What's the big deal? What's your response to that?
Well, first of all, Lee's job was in trouble. It's been formally made clear to him that his continued employment at the Intercept is going to be dependent upon his ability to avoid upsetting colleagues in his social media comments. The process of being denounced as a racist and have 30,000 people like it, including many of your colleagues, many of the people that you work with, prominent people from other news organizations, just piling on and using this incredibly destructive term that is basically not survivable. I mean, if you're labeled a racist in this corner of the media, you really can't work. Mm-hmm. So if he were to lose his job as a result of that, where is he going to go? Fox after that? I mean, it's difficult, and it's personally devastating to go through this. I mean, there's nothing like this, and it's also unanswerable. You know, I mean, I think that's one of the things that's very difficult about all this. So what is really really difficult about this is that when somebody does something that you dislike, and they call you, they use one of these terms in response, there's no bouncing back from it. The game's already up at that point, reputationally, and that's what people will do is they just won't go near it. Nobody's going to want to be Lee Fong, you know, going forward.
So. Yeah, I mean, I think I would love to see Nathan Robinson get denounced, and we'll see whether he thinks it's such a big deal. But Matt, one of the things I also loved about his little response here is he writes something, a quote, which might be true empirically, but.
Right.
And so he basically is like admitting that there was an empirical, I mean, it is empirically proven that riots and looting do move against public opinion, something that Lee had pointed out. And David Shore, who is another person that you chronicled, but basically discounting empirical evidence. I mean, that is something that I think is just, I mean, it's just an anti-intellectual project at that point.
Well, right. And again, a lot of the arguments, the problem that I have with all this is that in all of these instances, what we're talking about is people who just don't want to see something that's actually happening because it contradicts their political views. So, you know, in the case of that social scientist David Shore, who gets fired because he retweets a study by an African American social scientist, by the way, who had done a study suggesting that nonviolent protest is more efficacious than violent protest. The problem isn't that those views are problematic. It's that you shouldn't be fired for publishing legitimate research, no matter what the content of it is.
Right.
And that's the Robinson's critique, which I thought was crazy. The first thing he says is I concede the empirical truth of that study, but I don't think it's a very good study. And he doesn't seem to be terribly upset. I mean, even though he says, I don't think he should have been fired for it. He that's the entire point of the episode. Why are we discussing it otherwise?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And this gets to the Lee episode as well. Like Lee, he runs an interview that some people don't like because it has a message they don't like, but it actually happened. The guy's real. I talked to him, you know, like you can't, what are you going to do? Not run it? I mean, that's not what we do.
Well, and I also wanted to get your view on what happened with Tom Kahn, which we covered here extensively on this show. So he publishes this op-ed, I think it was called, like, Send in the Military, after President Trump's Rose Garden speech, where he threatens to invoke the Insurrection Act and send active duty military into American cities to quell riots. So I had some issues with Cotton's op-ed in terms of, you know, I thought it was sort of, there were some propagandistic elements that shaded the truth that weren't totally upfront. But I also acknowledge his view is one that was held by the President of the United States and was held by some not insignificant portion of the American public. The fallout from that obviously ends in the op-ed page editor, James Bennett, ultimately resigning. Now, part of, and this is one thing that Nathan raised that I thought was legitimate, part of why he resigned is because he admitted he hadn't read this op-ed before it was even published, which seems like, you know, this is your job. You should have taken a look at this thing before it hit the pages of the paper. And also, I thought the New York Times response was fairly abhorrent, and they basically tried to throw this one relatively young staffer under the bus. So I guess for different reasons, I am comfortable with some heads rolling on the handling and treatment of that op-ed, while I think that the decision to run it was probably the right call ultimately.
Yeah, people took a lot of my piece to be in defense of the Cotton editorial. That wasn't the case at all. The thing that I really had trouble with in that episode was the fact that he resigned basically because he was getting a message that if your decision to run this editorial put Black lives in danger, put the lives of Black staff in danger, which is an unanswerable charge. I mean, there's nothing you can say in response to that is going to be satisfactory. And I think absent that, traditionally editors would have said, okay, fine, take it under consideration. You know, we'll run a rebuttal editorial. What else do you want to do about it? But in that environment, it was that charge that really sealed the fate of this editor. And again, it's the same thing over and over again in all these episodes. Somebody says this is racist, therefore that person has to be fired. And then in the David Shore episode, with Lee, he's racist, he has to go to HR to save his job and craft a public apology. Here it's, you know, you put the lives of Black staff in danger and you got to go. And it's this mechanism that's being repeated over and over again. And it's a third rail topic. It's not comfortable, but it's a style of thought that is, I think, really dangerous.
Yeah, and I want to end on this note, Matt. Tell everybody your credentials on writing about police brutality, because I think that's one of the things that a lot of people might have forgotten in this episode.
Yeah, I spent 5 years of my life on this topic. I wrote two books that were about inequities in the criminal justice system. I wrote a book called The Divide that I spent 2 years on that, basically comparing how rich Wall Street offenders were treated as compared to poor Black defendants. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote a book called I Can't Breathe, which is the Eric Garner story, which obviously has a lot of pertinence to the George Floyd incident. The two cases were very similar. This is a deeply, profoundly, you know, important issue to me personally. And I'm not like a Blue Lives Matter type of person by any stretch of the imagination. This is more, I'm worried about something that I think doesn't have a whole lot to do with race at all. This has to do with a new style of thought that has permeated newsrooms and really has been consistent throughout all these moral manias since Hillary's election, whether we're talking about Russiagate, Ukrainegate, whatever. If you step outside the line, there are going to be consequences, and that can't be the atmosphere we want to work in.
Okay. That's a part of a longer interview, but you get the gist of it. All someone has to do is make a statement on the internet about you, and your reputation's over. I was just informed that there was an article about Robert F. Kennedy Jr., cover story of Vanity Fair. And so they sent it over. I read it. It is an extremely biased article, and I'm going to invite Robert on this program to respond to it. But they didn't mention any of the good things that he does. And he's not a vaccine denier. Yet they are trying to make him one of the dirty 12, like Dr. Who was on that list? Someone mentioned the list, but I haven't gone over and read the list. In any case, there are 12 people in there. I think Sayer G is on there, AgreeMed Info. And I don't see Sayer G is very responsible as a journalist. And Robert Kennedy's on there. And there's some other people on there as well. But none of them are writing things or doing videos that I've watched that are inaccurate. They're just challenging the prevailing view that the vaccines are safe and effective and everybody should get them. They should be mandated. Just on the basic science is wrong. If someone has had COVID and tests positive for the antibodies, that means that their body has met COVID, defeated it, and now has protective antibodies. The question is, how long do those antibodies last? We don't have an absolute answer. Now, if you get the chickenpox, you get the measles, you're immune for life. But with COVID, it's a virus that can mutate and does mutate, and therefore, will you still be protected? In part, you'll be protected because of even the mutations are still very close to the same virus. So you're going to be protected for anywhere from 9 months up to as long as it ultimately is shown that you'll be protected. But why would you get a vaccine? That's only presenting a challenge to the body. What if you have autoimmune conditions? That's over 130 million people have autoimmune conditions in the United States. They should not be getting a vaccine because that could help throw them into a critical state. In fact, I was just looking. As of today, the Varis Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System in the United States shows 160,000 injuries and 4,400 deaths. Now, that's 300% less than the reporting from the European Union's science group that collects data. And it's just about the same amount of doses, 245 million doses in the United States and 251 in the European Union. Well, why does the European Union show 160,000 injuries, severe injuries, in the United States? We're at a substantially reduced number. That is around 50,000 or so. Where clearly we are not reporting accurately, all right? It's just not accurate. Now, in the European Union, they have 406,000 adverse reactions, many of those requiring hospitalization. Many of those people may die. In the United States, 160,000. So if we really looked at the honest figures, we'd be looking at about 40,000 deaths, upwards of 40,000 deaths in the United States, and possibly as many as, probably around a million plus injuries. Well, now that's something they would immediately have to stop. So instead of looking what they should do, the precautionary principle of first do no harm, they're exploiting this as far as they got the pedal to the metal. They are doing all they can to exploit every nickel out of this. And part of that is to keep us terrified with misinformation and distractions. So just want to let you know, look for the truth, but where it's actually at. Oh, and by the way, interesting, from orientalreview.org, Leonard Savin, Bill Gates vaccination microchips and patent 060606. Quote, the case described below relates to an officially documented fact, although there is something rather biblical about it. Patent 2020-060606 was registered on March 26, 2020. The patent application was filed by Microsoft Technology Licensing LLC, headed by Bill Gates, but back on 20th of June 2019. And on the 22nd of April 2020, the patent was granted international status. The title of the patent is Cryptocurrency System Using Body Activity Data, end quote. So what is this invention that the people of Microsoft decided to patent? The abstract of the patent application online states, quote, human body activity associated with a task provided to the user may be used in a mining process of a cryptocurrency system. A server may provide a task to a device of a user which is communicatively coupled to the server. A sensor communicative coupling compromised in the device of the user may sense body activity of the user. Anyhow, in other words, in lay language, a chip will be inserted into your body that monitors your daily physical activity in return for cryptocurrency. So if conditions are met, then the person receives certain bonuses that can be spent on something. Wow. So when someone's talking about cryptocurrency and the great new reset, we shouldn't have cash, understand they're not doing that because they want to see you improve. They're exploiting it. They have the deals. They have the patents. So when that happens, every transaction, they'll be making money from it. How bad it is. Also something that concerns all of us and should. This should not be partisan. It should not be ideological and certainly should not be political. I believe that certainly all of us who are progressives and promote progressive ideals, which is nonviolence, respect of all life, respect of all religions and all ethnicities and cultural backgrounds, we don't want to see the Middle East erupt in another bloodbath. I don't want to see a single Jew killed, injured, or threatened. I don't want to see a single Palestinian killed, threatened, or injured. But unfortunately, the leaders of different countries and their supporters hold different views. So I was watching the media. I went through all the media, from the BBC, the New York Times, CNN, everyone. It's only one-sided. So to balance that, you have a chance to call in and share your points of view. And before you do that, we're going to go to another video clip. And this is about Sagar and Jetty. New details revealed Fauci media cover-up of lab leaks hypothesis. Let's listen to what they have to say. Again, you can agree or disagree to the relevance of this material.
Radar. Well, a story I've done my best to track since the very beginning of the pandemic is the lab leak hypothesis. Why? Not because it's a dunk on China necessarily, but because its treatment reveals how the culture war in America today corrupts basic facts. It poisons the ability of our media and the elite class to do basic reasoning. And because the more you dig, you realize if the lab leak hypothesis is in fact true, we have learned nothing from this horrific event and are probably even more at risk of another one in the future. A new entrant onto the scene of reporting out the lab leak hypothesis was introduced. Stunning new facts, and it puts the mainstream media to shame. It gives even more credence to the theory. Nicholas Wade, he's a former science correspondent for the New York Times, out with a bombshell new multi-thousand word study for the Bureau of Atomic Scientists, in which he does what I consider to be the best job so far of investigating the origins of the outbreak. If you don't know the broad contours of the lab leak theory, let me lay it out for you. We know coronavirus came from Wuhan, China, where there happens to be a lab called the Wuhan Institute of Virology. That lab was conducting a type of research known as gain-of-function research, where scientists attempt to create viruses which are more powerful than known in nature, the theory being that you can then create cures for potential diseases of the future. That type of research is incredibly risky, so much so it was banned for a time by the U.S. government under the Obama administration. But what we now know is Dr. Anthony Fauci, the so-called hero of the pandemic himself, is the chief proponent of gain-of-function research within the U.S. government. So much so, he worked within the Trump administration to overturn that ban while nobody was looking in 2017. We now also know with certainty the U.S. government, under Fauci, funded gain-of-function research at the Wuhan lab into bat coronaviruses. We also know that the very people charged with investigating whether coronavirus leaked from the lab are those that facilitated funding of the type of research itself. In short, it's not about blaming China. If anything, if coronavirus did leak from a lab, it is the biggest indictment of the public health establishment in America. That we knowingly have been funding dangerous research in places with substandard safety protocols, which may have caused the worst pandemic in nearly a century. Okay, so you're with me. Here is where Nicholas Wade comes in with some stunning new reporting and analysis, which dramatically indicts American authorities. Wade lays out how the NIH and the NIAID funneled dollars to gain-of-function research in Wuhan despite a U.S. government ban, that this funneling occurred specifically because Dr. Fauci or Dr. Francis Collins or possibly both overruled U.S. government policy through an exemption loophole. And Wade quotes an expert who says both of these officials, quote, have systematically thwarted efforts by the White House, Congress, scientists, and science policy specialists to regulate gain-of-function research of concern. In other words, Fauci, the hero of the pandemic, was intimately involved in funding and perpetuating the research that very likely is what caused this entire thing in the first place. And the cover-up here really is stunning. I'm sure all of you are again wondering why you need to listen to a guy on YouTube like me or Joe Rogan read this type of article in a non-mainstream source just to get the most basic facts about probably one of the most important stories of the century. It's on that question, too, where Wade shines, writing, quote, "To my knowledge, no major newspaper or TV network has yet provided readers with an in-depth news story of the lab escape scenario, which the one you have just read. Worse, he lays out how in the world of science reporting, journalists are usually not skeptical of the claims of their sources, like one may be in political reporting, that this was very cynically exploited by the very scientists who may be responsible for this entire thing. But the real reason is one that we all know. The reason the media didn't do any of this is because Trump said it was real back in March. And look, he didn't do it because he knew it was for certain. He did it because he wanted to avoid blame. But just to avoid giving him even an ounce of credit, they refused to do this investigation and unwittingly have become useful idiots for a multi-million dollar industry which is cooking up dangerous viruses under the guise of keeping us all safe. Will they correct their mistakes? You already know the answer. Journalist Michael Tracy, he went back. He messaged some of these journalists from the Washington Post, New York Times, The Daily Beast, Huffington Post, Kaiser Family Foundation, many more, on whether they would update or correct their stories in light of all this new evidence. Not one responded to him. Why does all this matter? Can't we just say, move on, he might say? No, because if the media refuses to do its job, this can all happen all over again. And it already is. In response to the pandemic, scientists have now cooked up a $1.2 billion scheme known as the Global Virome Project, which is a, quote, 10-year collaborative scientific initiative to discover unknown zoonotic viral threats and stop future pandemics. In other words, it's $1 billion more dollars thrown at gain-of-function research for a whole host of new unknown viruses. Who will do the investigation into whether any of this is safe? Will Congress come to its senses and say, hell no, we're not allowing that here? And if the U.S. government or U.S. taxpayers are trying to fund it, then maybe we should ban it. Answering the question as to the origin of the coronavirus is the only way that we can determine what is and what is not safe in the future. And unfortunately, our media has doomed us to a possible round two, and we only hope that the next one is not as bad as this one was.
So the top reporter, one of America's leading investigative journalists, has just completely shredded the whole idea that this virus came just innocently out of nature. And he tied it all into Anthony Fauci. Anthony Fauci's funding, working with a person out of this nonprofit out of New York, and then taking that money and research and gain research, function research down to University of North Carolina, and then taking it all over the Wuhan lab. So the media, unfortunately, has been an apologist for Anthony Fauci and everything about COVID, and they've been proven wrong on almost every single fact. So let's hope that other journalists have the same courage. And by the way, just to give you some additional insights as to what's not happening. This is from American Institute for Economic Research, Michael Fumento, liberals turning against the lockdown left. Quote, writing in the May 4th, 2021 Atlantic, quote, the liberals who can't quit lockdown, Emma Green admits that many of us suspected, including anti-Trumpers, that for many progressives, extreme vigilance was in part about opposing Donald Trump. End quote. Indeed, a survey that Bill Maher would later cite of American media coverage of the pandemic showed a significant fall off of the, quote, we're going to die articles right after the election. She also gently chides some of her fellow liberals, stating, quote, even as scientific knowledge of COVID has increased, some progressives have continued to embrace policies and behaviors that aren't supported by evidence, such as banning access to playgrounds, closing beaches, and refusing to reopen schools for in-person learning, end quote. Green says this may actually be encouraging a sort of backlash on the right. Quote, those who are vaccinated on the left seem to think overcaution now is the way to go, which is making people on the right question the effectiveness of the vaccines, end quote. So anyhow, so there is backdown. So people were not all engaged in doing something because it was the right thing to do. They were frankly engaging things because it was the politically right thing to do, so they thought, and they had been wrong. I'll just give you a couple examples of the latest wrong on this. This is from today from the National File. MIT, that's Massachusetts Institute of Technology, study suggests 6-foot social distancing, limited occupancy rules are completely pointless. After over a year, scientists have determined that social distancing and limited occupancy rules may be totally useless. This is a new study conducted by MIT scientists just released. All right, so one more of these barriers is falling down. And now it'll become acceptable. Oh, yeah, you don't have to social distance. And by the way, this is from Great Game India. An official tally of suspected adverse effects resulting from COVID-19 vaccines has surpassed 30,000 in just Sweden alone. And the majority of the cases are happening in people vaccinated with AstraZeneca, vaccinated, branded as COVID Shield in India. So that's just another country, as well as the deaths that come from that. Also, to those great major corporations that seem to be so important to our well-being, according to The Guardian, quote, chemical giants hid dangers of forever chemicals in food packaging. The chemicals called 6.2-FTOHA are now linked to a range of serious health issues, and Americans are still being exposed to them. Chemical giants DuPont and Daikin knew the dangers of these chemical compounds widely used in food packaging since 2010, but hid them from the public and the Food and Drug Administration. And so The Guardian has obtained this information. So they lied. Like the grease-proof pizza boxes, carry-out containers, fast food wrappers, paperboard packaging, toxic. They knew and they lied. So if they lied about that, what are they also willing to lie about? All right? So it's, you know, this is why we must be diligent, keep focused on all this. Now, what about this? This is something new. It's a new article. It's called Masks Create Permanent Neurological Damage. German neurologist on face mask, quote, oxygen deprivation causes permanent neurological damage. This was in Technocracy News. I'll play that clip for you on our next program. But now, I want to play a clip. I have had no calls in. I thought I would have some calls. These are important issues. And I want to play a clip that is very similar sounding to Anthony Fauci. Let's hear that.
So this comedian doing a great Dr. Fauci imitation is only doing what Dr. Fauci would do, and that is to use a scientific medical term.
I'd say even if you live alone, I would wear a mask in the house, especially in the shower, because frankly, droplets can make the way through the drain and come up through somebody else's toilet, infecting them with COVID through the anus. Ballpark, in 2 to 5 to 20 years, we can start thinking about considering the idea of pondering the thought of conceptualizing the possibility of maybe, perhaps, reopening, but probably not. I would avoid having any fun whatsoever in the near to far future.
For him. Jesus. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.